Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
And now, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints presents Enduring It Well. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. This verse from Ecclesiastes 3, verse 1, assures us there is a greater plan in motion for each of us individually, and all of us collectively as children of a loving Father in heaven. Our lives are filled with learning opportunities presented to us with each 24-hour rotation of the earth on its axis. But what if one near and dear to us is removed from life in what we might consider an untimely manner? How does it feel to grow up not knowing one's father, mother, or sibling, relying only on tender stories and faded photographs to fill the void? How do the sealing ordinances of the temple provide a bond that reaches across the years, giving comfort and reassurance despite the mortal separation? A mother, father, and children sealed in the holy house of the Lord will see one another again, and relationships put on hold will resume and flourish forever, as promised by a loving Heavenly Father, because of the selfless sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Welcome to the conclusion of A Silent Hero, Part 2, with Leah Clark, the only daughter of firefighter Calvin Clark and his wife Cheryl Clark Monk. You are listening to Enduring It Well with host W.A. Christensen.
In A Silent Hero Part 1, we learned of Calvin Clark, a quiet firefighter afflicted with a severe speech impediment who lived a good, righteous life, judging no one and loving all around him. Just as his life was beginning to improve, having been sealed to his sweetheart Cheryl and experiencing the birth of his daughter Leah, a child the two never thought they would have, tragedy struck. On a seemingly routine call one morning, Calvin climbed a fire ladder to rescue a cat stranded on a high power pole. Unexpectedly, the cat jumped onto Calvin's shoulders and then to the ground, scurrying off into the empty field. As the cat hit Calvin's shoulders, somehow the electricity from the high power lines arced through the cat and onto the rescue ladder, going in one hand, through Calvin's heart, and out the other hand. In that moment, Calvin's life ended. For mother and daughter, a new life without daddy ensued. Fast forward 30 years, where daughter Leah, on September 11, 2001, walks to work as a fitness trainer in the gym on the 22nd floor of World Trade Center 3, the Marriott Hotel. The beautiful blue sky above caught Leah's attention, and she decided she would spend her break out in the World Trade Center Plaza later in the morning. As she waited for the elevator that morning, intending to take her break on the plaza, she heard her firefighter father warn her not to get on that elevator. Minutes later, the horror of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center complex turned the blue sky to darkness. Leah joins us today on Enduring It Well to describe what she went through on that day and the post-traumatic stress that plagued her after that experience. She will also tell us the comfort she feels knowing that the eternal bond with her father is still real and very much in force, even 40 years after his untimely and tragic death. I can't believe how wonderful it is to see you after all these years, Leah. The last time I really remember seeing you was the day your father blessed you in our sacrament meeting. Welcome to Enduring It Well.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit what you remember your mother telling you about your father.
I just remember, you know, her giving me examples of the kind of man that he was, his integrity in different circumstances, his non-judgment on others. You know, he didn't see disability, he didn't see color, he didn't see any of those things that so often we judge people on. He had a great sense of fairness and being able to stick up for what he believed in, not just for himself, but if he were to see something else happening, he didn't have a problem speaking up.
Literally, physically, he had a difficulty in speaking up with the stuttering, but he still had the courage and the stamina to stick up for someone despite the stammering.
Well, I think he had just such a genuine belief in everyone's goodness. that everyone has a, you know, has a purpose. And I kind of think that's kind of where I get that from, is that sense of everyone is good. You just see the good in people and not the, the bad or the evil.
Just observing, it sounds to me like your mother must have done a fairly good job in helping you understand who he was, so that you weren't just always, you know, thirsting to know this father. You seemed to know him, even though he wasn't in the home.
She was always willing to talk about if I had a question, or she was always willing to point something out. Oh, you know, it's exactly what your father would have done, or, oh, you look just like your father in that moment, or if I had questions, she was always, it was never, let's talk about that later. It was never a hush-hush moment that I remember. It, she was always happy to talk about him.
And would you recommend that to other families who may be in a circumstance like that? What is your recommendation?
I don't think it does anyone any good to hide it. I think it's important for us to understand maybe where we come from or the influences that they've had on us, big or small.
Have you ever tried to put yourself in your mother's shoes a bit? Have you ever used that great tool of empathy and stepped in her shoes for a moment and said, wow, I can't believe what she went through, and I can't believe that she had to turn around and take me away from that hospital, you know, saying goodbye to my dad, to her husband?
Many, many times. I can't even fathom what she went through that day. How terrifying to not know what tomorrow's going to bring, and that you've lost so much, and just a flash. And, you know, I admire her strength and resolve. She's always put me and my brothers first, our family first, and even if she had not gotten married soon, she would have figured out a way to make it work. Absolutely would have made, you know, made the best of it.
So now, Leah, you had an interesting experience happen to you. You were living in New York City, and you were there at Ground Zero the day that September 11th that we all know. We all have observed it in some fashion or another over and over again, and a horrible day in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you saw.
It was a stunningly beautiful morning. So often as a New Yorker, you are just on the go, 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 and you forget in between all the skyscrapers and all the busyness to look up and appreciate some of the small things. And that day I was heading into work at World Trade 3, which sat between the two towers. And I had an early morning client. I worked at was a personal trainer. And my first client was at 7:30. So I was walking through the plaza that all the buildings pretty much backed up to, where there was a plaza, a big fountain. And I come up out of the train and was walking to work through the plaza. And I remember looking up at the sky and saying to myself, wow, what an amazing morning. It is so beautiful out here. And I just remember the intensity, the blue of the sky. I thought to myself, on my break, I'm going to come out here and make some phone calls and enjoy the morning. And I had a break around 8:30 for about an hour and a half. So I figured it'd come out, it's a perfect morning to do so. I did my clients and was getting ready to go down to the plaza. It was probably about 8:35. I got my backpack out of the locker room and pushed the elevator button and stood there with a few people waiting for the elevator. And as the door opened up, something just said to me, do not get on the elevator. And I remember thinking, what? Like, do not get on the elevator. Just from so many other experiences, I had tried to remember to listen to those things and be conscious of them. I thought to myself, that is strange. How weird. But okay, just, all right, I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to listen to that voice. And I decided not to go down. And I went back into our offices and found open office. Both sides of our building were all windows. And as I sat down and started to make phone calls, less than 10 minutes, I was on the phone on hold, and I heard a plane come in. I didn't think to look out the window, because why would I even see the plane? I mean, it didn't even register that that was a possibility. And I didn't think that I would see anything. I was on the top floor of our building, which was 22 stories. Before I could think anything, I said to myself, wow, that plane seems low. And then it hit. The building shook. It just, everything shook. And it was just, it was like instantaneous chaos in a way, but it wasn't screaming and yelling. It wasn't anything like that. It just saw pieces from the ceiling kind of coming in, coming down. There was an Olympic-sized pool and, you know, huge, huge gym. And I didn't even think that the plane had hit. Even though, looking back, it makes sense. At the time, I just didn't think. I thought there was an explosion of some sort or there was a bomb of some sort. It didn't register as a possibility again. I just had a whole bunch of people gather underneath the desk. Physically had to grab a couple people because they were just in shock. They had already been through the 93 bombings, and they just were stayed in shock and couldn't do it. They just stood there like, you know, in shock.
So you grabbed them and pulled them out?
Yeah, I literally had to run out and grab them and put them under the table to cover their heads. And I probably had 5 or 6 people under the desk with me. Immediately, you couldn't see out of any of the windows. You could not see anything but papers or glass just shining in the air. But lots and lots of papers, and it just was continuing to fall. It was just like this constant waterfall of papers. Mm. Once we stopped shaking, I sent those people and anyone else that was there down to the north exit, which was the closest exit, to go down. And below us just happened to be the Marriott Hotel. We were an executive fitness center, but the whole hotel top floor was right below us, although we catered to private clients. And I proceeded to go towards the south exit.
So you sent them to the north, but you proceeded to go south. And why?
I wanted to make sure there wasn't anybody else in the locker rooms, in the steam room, in the sauna, like in shock or cowering or not being able to get out, because I didn't know what had happened.
And so to a degree, you sort of took on this role as a first responder, really. You were trying to help figure out how to get people out of there.
I guess so. I didn't think about it that way. As I passed our cardio room, our marble floor had already fallen. The marble staircase had already fallen. Hmm. And I just continued to the locker rooms and to make sure that I couldn't find anyone else, and then proceeded down the south emergency exit stairway to the next floor down, where I wanted to get to the people that I had sent down. And so as I ran across the top floor of the Marriott Hotel, you could see that the maids had left their carts and the people had left their doors. Some people had left their doors open. It was like kind of a ghost town in a weird sort of a way. And I just started knocking on doors on my way. As I hit a closed door, I would just knock and just say, "You need to get out." As I did that on the way down, I did that on every floor. I just stopped on every floor and I knocked on as many doors as I could. People would come out and say, "They told us to stay put. They told us to stay, did not to leave, and that we weren't in any danger." Still not knowing what was going on, I just said, "You can do as you wish, but I'm telling you that my ceiling is coming down and I'm on the top floor and there's weights and there's an Olympic-sized pool and you need to get out. It's up to you." And I had to move on. Like, I couldn't. They had to make their own decision. Very surreal. And I didn't know what to make of it. All I knew is that we needed to get out.
And by this time, how much time had gone on now?
By this time, I feel like it took me a while to get out because I hit every floor. As I hit every floor and knocked on doors, that just took some that time. Much more time, and it being 21 floors of the hotel. So the whole time I was trying to call my mom. I was trying to reach her because she was here in Colorado, and I just thought, I can't have her wake up and turn on the Today Show or the news and realize what's happened. She's already lost my dad. I didn't want her to be in a panic, and but I couldn't get through the cell phones because when it hit the North Tower, it knocked out the cell service. I just proceeded down each floor and you know, strangely enough, I didn't ever think to pull the fire alarm because I didn't see a fire. I thought about that afterwards. Why didn't I just pull the alarm? That would have been so much easier to get everyone out, but when you are taught that that's what that's for. But I just kind of eventually just kind of led the pack down. As we got down to the bottom, to the last few floors of the exit, I kind of got in front, and as we got to the bottom, it led out strictly to the plaza. It didn't lead out to the plaza inside the hotel, or inside, it led strictly to the outside. And once I saw what was in the plaza, I quickly turned everyone around and was out. There were bodies and debris and things still falling. So everybody immediately, we had to find another way out. Eventually we got into the plaza level inside the hotel, and I knew a lot of the security because we were inside the same building as the hotel, so I knew a lot of those people and the hotel workers. They just came through to everyone and was saying, "You're safe here. It's not our building. You're safe." And I just kept thinking, I have to get a hold of my mom. I can't get a hold of my mom. I couldn't get through the phones. And I just went to the payphone in the lobby. And I, to this day, I still don't know how I got through the payphone. I didn't have a calling card because I had a cell phone. I picked up the phone and I dialed her, and I don't know how I got through. I don't have any idea how I got through.
I'm just shocked that you found a payphone in this day and age. Usually you don't even find
those
anymore.
In the lobby of a hotel, there was still a payphone. There was like 5 payphones. And I picked up the phone and I called, and she was already hysterical. She was just screaming, "Get out, get out." And I said, I'm alive, I'm okay. I don't know what's going on, but there's been an explosion. I said, "Okay, I'll get out. I'll call you as soon as I can get to a phone. I'm trying to get out of the building now." Just literally as the phone hit the receiver, the second plane hit. I mean, it was literally as the phone hit the receiver. The security came through and they just said, "Everybody out." Well, the problem is that in the front of the hotel, you couldn't go because debris and falling. And so they were trying to figure out how to get people out of the building because you couldn't. Now it's hit the South Tower.
So it's surrounded, really.
So now you're surrounded. And again, we just heard another explosion. I didn't know a plane hit the building. And didn't know it was the South Tower necessarily. But again, more debris and more things flying. You couldn't see out the windows. And so they sent us to on the corner of West Side Highway. And on the corner that the building sat, they decided to have us exit. And they said, "When we tell you to go, you have to go. And you just cover your head and you run." And we had to run across 8 lanes or so of highway.
Wow.
Diagonally across south. And just as I got to the door, they say, "Get ready." And this huge chunk of cement just came flying down in front of the glass doors and just shattered everywhere. And they said, "Go." And I just covered my head and I was just running. And as I'm running across the street, as I'm running diagonally across the highway towards south of the World Financial into Battery Park, I'm just seeing people's belongings, a shoe, a briefcase, someone's tie, knowing that now I'm seeing huge plane parts, and I'm thinking, what is going on? Why is all this stuff? I mean, I still hadn't registered what had really happened yet. Once I got to the sidewalk, so many traders and people were out on the sidewalk. It was just packed. And as I walked south, you saw everyone trying to use their cell phones and basically no one getting through. People crying, people upset. And as I turn around and I'm watching this and I'm watching the buildings both on fire and plane parts and all kinds of stuff, I'm watching people wave their whatever they could out of the windows. As black smoke came out the windows from behind them, you can't imagine. I just kept walking south. I was just walking kind of backwards, just watching all of this unfold, and kept thinking, how are they on fire? Like, how do 2 planes hit? Like, by this time I'd picked up what people were saying, that planes had hit, so I was figuring out, you know, but how do 2 planes hit? I still wasn't thinking terrorism. Kept thinking, they're going to get to these people. They're going to get to these people and rescue them. It just didn't happen. And I just kept trying to get to a phone. I kept trying to find a payphone. And of course, there's no payphones. I mean, I was going through Battery Park City, which has a lot of residential and, you know, some stores, but most people have cell phones, so payphones weren't readily available. And so I was going into every apartment building that I could. Now I'm walking back north towards the World Trade Center and along, you know, kind of right along the river on West Side Highway. And as I walked in, I was probably a block or two away from the World Trade at this point. I walked into a building and I ran into someone I knew that lived there. And she says, come with me. I still have a landline. You know, you can use my phone. Take as long as you need. You know, let's go. And as I went up, I just thought, okay, I can call my mom and everything's okay. I can call my family and tell them I'm all right and I'm out and I'm safe and everything's fine. So she left to go find and check on some other friends. And I just sat and watched it on TV as I was talking to family and, you know, trying to listen to the news. And
what was that conversation like with your mother?
I just remember her crying. And at that point, I had kind of emotionally shut down, I think.
Yeah.
I think shock had, at that point, just seeing all the things that I had already seen, but I didn't realize it at the time. I think I was just in survival mode, pure survival mode. And I said, I'm okay. I'm going to get out of here. I'll let you know as soon as I get somewhere safe. I'm across the street. Probably everybody never thought that they would fall. I think she was probably relieved when she heard my voice that I was out, but scared that I wasn't out of the area. And in New York City, you know, anything can happen. And talked to everyone, except for my, I was just finishing up, I was talking to my brother, MJ, who lived in San Francisco at the time. And I just was finishing speaking with him. And I had told my mom earlier, I will call you when I get to wherever I can get. I will call you. So I'm out of the area. I will promise to call you. I talked to my brother, and I wasn't in front of the TV. I heard what sounded like, I don't know how to describe it, but it sounded like we were being dive bombed. I thought we were actually at this point now being attacked, like a Pearl Harbor type situation where we were being attacked from the enemy. And they were flying in, and almost like machine guns where you could hear it, you know, boom, 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 boom. But it wasn't machine guns. It wasn't people shooting at us. And I started to scream, which is really unlike me because I'm not a screamer. And I'm not a hey, look at me kind of person, yeah. But I was on the phone with my brother, and I just started screaming hysterically. I was like, not again, not again. And there was no place for me to hide. All I could do was have an empty wall. And I started to scream, and as I was screaming, my brother was like, Leah, and then everything went dead, and then everything went pitch black.
So you were that close.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was literally across the street. I was across the street. And it was just pitch black, and all the windows were open, and I ran over. Once I realized I was okay, I ran over and shut the windows, and then everything kind of came back on again, and I was trying to figure out what happened, and that noise were the towers coming down, floor by floor by floor. Didn't even know what to do with all of that. There are people in there. Like, how is that? What just happened? Now at this point, I just want to go home. That's all I want to do. I want to go home. I kind of think I stopped in a way processing. Like I said, the emotions weren't really there. I don't think. Well, they weren't there for a long time.
Right.
I had gone down to the lobby and then realized I couldn't get back into the apartment. Then the building came through and said, you can't be down here. There's too much glass. We don't know what's going to happen. We can't be responsible. So I went to the basement, and they say, you can't be here. We can't be responsible. And I'm talking with a gentleman who was just in town for business. His hotel was uptown. He'd only been town overnight. He's only in town for one day.
And that's the day.
That's the day. And some people had recognized me from the gym, and they said, come with us. And I said, well, he's coming with me, too. So I took him and we all went to this apartment, and this couple had a newborn baby, was probably less than 2 weeks old. And they took us in and we listened to the radio for hours, and just listening for any news, because there were no trains, no subways, no taxis, no buses. I mean, there was no form of transportation, completely shut down. And as you know, New York never shuts down. We just waited and waited, and my phone seemed to work on occasion. So I would call my family, and then I would let other people call their families. We just were kind of waiting it out, and about 2 o'clock, me and another girl, we said, let's go. We're going to go out into it. Problem was is that there's a lot of ash and soot, inches deep. Everything's just white. Thankfully, that day I had worn my glasses and not my contacts, because I probably had a really hard time with all the glass in the air and fiberglass and all the debris. And they tore up a T-shirt for us and gave us a bottle of water and said good luck. And we just doused the T-shirt with water and covered our nose and our mouth so we wouldn't breathe it in as much as possible. And then just started to walk. And I've never seen New York so deserted. It was eerie. I walked south towards the Statue of Liberty, and then we cut across east, kind of through the Wall Street area. And I probably saw that entire time 10 or 15 people, tops.
Which is, just doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. You see 10 or 15 people on one corner.
Yeah.
You know, in a 10-foot range, you can see 15 people. And, I lived in Brooklyn. I was going to walk across the bridge, Brooklyn Bridge. Just as we got to the South Street Seaport area, they said, first ferry is running to Brooklyn, 5 minutes. So I ran, and I took the ferry to Brooklyn. I just remember watching as we crossed the river. It just, there were no towers, and the skyline has never been the same. Just so much was missing. So much smoke and debris and chaos, and you can't even process it.
Were you able to start, if one even can do this, to comprehend the loss of life?
No. I was still thinking, like so many others, that they were going to find people alive. Still hopeful. Once I got to Brooklyn, in my own mind of not processing what was going on, I was going to hop on the train to my stop. If the trains aren't running in the Manhattan, they're not running in Brooklyn. I just wasn't processing any of that information.
But how could you? No,
it just
this had never happened before.
Right. It just didn't make sense. I waited, and I was very frustrated. I waited probably 15-20 minutes on the platform for the train, and I was like, where is this train? And then it hit me. There are no trains. Even though I knew that, it just, things don't shut down there. And I got out, I caught a cab, we got about 2 blocks, and there was an emergency call where they said everyone has to be off the main road, so you can only be on a side road, like side street. And then traffic just didn't move. I just said, I'm going to get out and walk, thank you. And I got out and I walked home. And little did I know, my brother at that time that lived in D.C., he was already on his way. He'd already gotten his family safe and his new baby, and he was on his way to the Verrazano Bridge just to wait to try to get across, because all the bridges, of course, were cut down to traffic.
Tell me, as you've thought about this, how does one put what you went through into perspective, stepping back from it now? How do you process that? Did you seek counseling? Did you get counseling? Did that help? What did you go through?
Well, after it happened, it took me quite a few days to get home because there were so many security breaches.
And when you say home, where were you?
I meant back to Colorado, home to see family and my mom, and I just was numb to it all. I couldn't, it was very hard for me. I think I was probably in Colorado for 5 days, and I said, I have to go back to New York, because my life, like so many others in New York, had stopped. I had lost my job, I had lost friends, I had lost everything. How am I going to support myself? What am I going to do?
So, and then you had this need to get back there.
I did. I needed to be a part of the recovery. I needed to be back in New York, going through what everyone else was going through about where I lived. That was my life. I didn't know what that held for me. When I was home and I was talking to people and people were asking me my story here in Colorado, it was just very matter of fact. And I remember my mom pulled me aside and she says, you know this is going to hit you at some point, right? You know that this emotionally is going to hit you, and that you are in shock, you are numb right now.
And your mother is speaking from experience.
Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I know. So I went back to New York, started going through the motions of standing in lines and getting registered for, you know, the Red Cross. You had to get involved with all of these organizations and just to be registered for the World Trade Center Registry. That meant standing in line for 12 hours some days. It was a month later, that's the day I woke up and I couldn't get out of bed. I could not stop crying. I was almost convulsing. I was just crying so hard and so heavy, and I couldn't stop. And I had been crying at one point for hours, and I called my doctor, and I was like, I need help. I'm breaking down here. Like, I need help. Like, I started to deal with severe panic attacks right after 9/11. I'd started to have them, and they'd progressively gotten worse where they were debilitating.
Those panic attacks are based on a reality.
Mm-hmm.
How perceptive of you to have the courage to ask for help. A lot of people don't ask for help when they're in difficult situations, and you had the capacity to do that.
I knew that if I didn't get help right away, I was be in big trouble. I just knew if I didn't get something immediately, there was going to be bigger consequences.
So what happened?
I went to a therapist, and I was diagnosed with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and I was on medications for probably a good year and a half in therapy 2 to 3 times a week, solid.
So this is work.
Yeah, a lot of work.
You have to work at this.
Yeah, a lot of work. A lot of work.
And did you see progress right away, or was it a slow process?
It was a slow process.
And when did you start seeing that progress?
I probably didn't start seeing that sense of progress for about 8 or 9 months into it. The panic attacks were just so severe.
What stopped you from giving up on that? I could imagine anybody would say, gosh, I've been doing this for 5 months. I'm not seeing any progress.
I think I felt like my problems were so insignificant compared to these families losing loved ones, losing the breadwinners, losing fathers, losing mothers, losing brothers, losing sisters. I'm just having panic attacks and depression and PTSD and... Not to make light of that, but it's nowhere near losing a life.
How did you get through that?
For me, it was just very frustrating at times because I couldn't move through it.
And you seem to me to be very self-assured and independent and capable of doing that, and yet you couldn't. This was a change in your personality.
This was a good lesson that you can't control everything. I could just be walking and suddenly have a panic attack for no reason, nothing to set it off, and be doubled over in so much pain. And it just didn't make sense. But it's the body's response. It's the body has to heal. I think psychologically you have to heal when it's time for you to heal, as you know.
So, Lee, as you look back, do you think you're healed?
Yeah, I think that from that situation, it did take me a while to move through a lot of those things. But at the end of the day, I came through it a better person. I appreciated my family more, my friends more, the small things. And even right after 9/11, you saw so many acts of kindness that you would never have seen otherwise. Just out of the blue, people on the street in New York City saying hello to each other. It's very bizarre. But it seems so simple. That's just not what you do. You start appreciating those simple things and the fact that you have a job or the fact that you are working or the fact that you have your health.
And could you look up and see the blue sky, figuratively speaking, again? Here, you saw it that morning.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree, as I listened to you talk, that went away. That blue sky went away for a while.
Yeah, a long while. I think it was a long while.
And when did you get to that point where it was blue again?
I think it was really about a year and a half after the fact. I had still in therapy, and I told my therapist, I really feel like I'm in a good place. Like, I really feel I want to cut back our sessions, and I want to just see how I do. And she fought me on it, but my stubborn and independence, I knew that I really felt that I was better.
And how did it go?
And I was better. I never saw her again.
Let me ask you this then. I was there the day you were blessed, and I remember you as a baby and as a young toddler. You were raised with a sense. Your father gave you a priesthood blessing at the beginning of your life, and it was a short but sweet and very powerful blessing, and your life has unfolded. How has your understanding of who you are helped you through this traumatic experience that you went through? How has your understanding of where you're from, why you're here, and where you're going, how has that helped you?
I think I understand the greater picture. I have the support system of my parents and my family. And, you know, I think, you know, we all want to have a great impact on this world. And my growth, some days or some weeks, are two steps forward and one step back.
As we all do.
Yeah. And
and that's life, really.
Right. It really is. And I feel there's a purpose for all of us. And I know that, you know, my mom in this lifetime has taught me everything that she could teach me. Good principles and integrity and just good values of life and of living and of being a good human being. On the other side, you know I have a lot of those things within me that were not just my mom, but were my dad. So I got a double blessing there. Mm. You know, the integrity and the sense of right and wrong and good and the non-judgment. And I just know that even in my struggles, I have something to give back.
What does it mean to you when I say to you that you are, in fact, your mother and your father's legacy?
That's pretty, it's pretty intense, actually. I have not the experience yet to have a family yet, but I hope to, and hope to pass along, you know, those values. And, you know, all I can hope is that I, in the process of it all, that I make them proud.
I think it's fascinating that you have had to go through this experience. You know, as humans, we all experienced it to some degree or another, but you were there mm-hmm. in the shadow of it. What did you learn from it?
I learned to appreciate life. I learned that even in the most outrageous evil, goodness can come. I learned to look at the bigger picture. It's not always about the immediate. It was a good reminder of that. I knew that, but it was a good reminder. When you have an experience like that, I just really started to be even more grateful for my friends and my family and for my experiences.
You had some interaction with your father or impressions of your father.
Mm-hmm. Once that elevator door opened up, I think I felt that it was my dad looking after me and warning me and protecting me.
Here he was, a firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
You had your own personal firefighter.
Right.
And what does that say to you of that relationship across the veil?
Well, I just know that he's looking out for me always, kind of my guardian angel, so to speak, in so many different ways, in so many different scenarios. You know, I feel like he's always kind of had my back. Good supersedes evil. It's hard to believe in situations like that, but at the end of the day, it really will. It does prevail.
This has been Enduring It Well with host W.A. Christensen, presented by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.